Hi, this is Ben Trefney, news director at KALW. We're in a membership drive right now. You can support what we do. More than 70% of our funding comes from listeners like you. Please go to donate at kalw.org, click it, and keep these stories coming. Thank you.
KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Berkeley.
Berkeley, California.
Coming up, we'll see what's behind the debate about sex offender registries, redemption, and public safety.
Raise my taxes, do anything, but do what you have to do to stop the peddling of child porn.
Reconsidering the sex offender registry. Then we'll join our colleagues inside San Quentin State Prison to hear what it's like to be on lockdown.
Just being stuck in that cell without movement, I struggled to, stay sociable.
And in these times, how can we find racial peace and healing? Our guest says it starts with a realization.
We all are connected. We all are joined.
Come connect with us today on Cross Currents. First up, let's hear a top story today from our transportation reporter, Eli Wirtschafter.
The state legislature is moving ahead with a proposal that could increase the toll to cross the Bay Bridge by up to $3. New revenues would support a variety of local transportation projects, including new BART cars, Caltrain's extension to downtown San Francisco, and several highway projects. Supporters of the proposal say a toll increase would cut down on traffic by discouraging driving and improving public transit alternatives. But some critics of the bill say the deal is unfair, that East Bay residents would pay the most in bridge tolls, but that a lot of the toll money would support transportation projects in the South Bay. The bill was authored by South Bay State Senator Jim Beal. The proposal still needs approval from the state Senate by tomorrow, followed by the governor's signature. After that, it would be up to us, the voters in the Bay Area, to approve in a June or November election next year.
That's our transportation reporter, Eli Wirtschafter. If you've got a transportation story you want him to cover, email him at transportation@kalw.org. Earlier this month, a federal judge in Colorado made a ruling that could have implications in California. Judge Richard Matsch declared Colorado's sex offender registry unconstitutional. He wrote that making information about sex offenders accessible to the public was cruel and unusual punishment. That means addresses, ages, and photos. Now, a controversial effort to reform California's system is currently making its way through the state legislature. But some law enforcement groups and victims' rights advocates say sex offenders are incurably unstable and need to be watched. So, does having a public list of sex offenders prevent sexual violence, or is it an unnecessary lifetime punishment? KALW's Holly J. McDeed has the story behind the fears and realities shaping the state's response to sex crimes.
Fred Russ is the kind of guy you want to root for when you meet him. He just got married. Collages by his 2-year-old nephew fill his kitchen wall. He's applying for his pilot's license.
I guess it's like when you get when you first get your driver's license and you're first allowed to kind of venture out into the world and go explore.
Concord Tower, Experimental 78 Hotel Romeo, ready for takeoff on 3-2 left, like a left cross with the park.
He shows off a video of his first solo flight while his trainer kids around to loosen him up.
He's making jokes and funny faces, and I'm sweating bullets.
We're not using his real name to protect his identity, because if you Googled him, you'd learn that Ross is a sex offender. You'd also find his home address, photo, and the crime he pleaded guilty to. His home has been vandalized, and he says it's because of his past and the information in the sex offender registry. When Ross was 19, he pled guilty to child molestation. He was homeless. He was doing a lot of drugs. And one night, after some hard partying, he wandered back into his mother's house.
My stepsister and her friend were there, and I pretty much, I guess you could say, felt up my stepsister's friend. And, she was actually sleeping, and so she kind of came to, and she was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. What am I doing, really?" That's when I kind of snapped out of it.
The victim was under 14 years old. Her parents called the cops. Ross spent about a year in jail. He says he never intended to hurt anyone.
I mean, hopefully she was able to get through it and, you know, have a decent life. I had a lot of stuff going on. I was pretty emotionally disturbed. You know, I was dealing with being homeless and, you know, just having a lot of problems in life.
More than a decade later, when he finally sought out drug treatment, he was rejected from rehab programs because he's a registered sex offender.
I was devastated. I was like, you can't take me because I'm on the registry? I'm like, but that has nothing to do with what's going on here.
Ross got sober on his own, turned his life around. But every year, cops still show up at his home for checkups. People in his Contra Costa County neighborhood talk. He committed his crime 21 years ago, but he feels like he's being penalized to this day.
They say it's not punishment, but it's in my eyes, it is punishment.
The sex offender registry is designed to inform Ross's neighbors of his presence and his past, and to keep tabs on offenders who are considered dangerous to society. But there are side effects, and they can be dangerous too. Alcoholics and drug addicts can't get treatment. Sex offenders face discrimination when it comes to finding work or housing. And some argue that being on a registry for life is cruel and unusual punishment. So now there are efforts to reform sex registry laws while still keeping children safe from predators. The question is how? California's sex offender registry has been around for 70 years, but law enforcement agencies started publishing sex registries nationwide in 1996. This was after a spate of high-profile child abduction cases changed the way parents watched over their kids. Six-year-old Eden Patz in New York City, six-year-old Adam Walsh in South Florida, seven-year-old Megan Kanka in New Jersey, 12-year-old Polly Klass in Petaluma.
Well, the guy that murdered Polly was a recidivist violent offender. I mean, he had committed sex-centric crimes against women over the course of his entire criminal history.
Mark Klass eagerly joined the campaign to make the sex offender registry public months after his daughter Polly was kidnapped, raped, and killed in 1993.
And we were in a position where people didn't feel safe on their streets. And what happened to Polly made people feel unsafe even in their own homes. And there was a reaction to that.
Back then, it was almost impossible for anyone to know if neighbors or coaches, pastors, or babysitters were convicted sex offenders. So Klass campaigned for Megan's Law, which made information about sex offenders public.
Then we were fighting a fight that had never been fought before, and it was a fight to give people access to information that they could use to protect their families.
So when law enforcement groups like the California Police Chiefs Association and the Association of Deputy District Attorneys pushed for sex registry reforms in the state legislature, Klass was shocked. It felt like the systems he helped build to protect children were unraveling, the pendulum swinging against his life's work.
And all of a sudden, you know, people that were supposed to be punished for one way or another for long periods of time, all of a sudden, it's all done and well and done, and there are the victims left slack-jawed wondering, well, boy, they sure broke that promise to me, didn't they?
The changes currently before the state legislature would allow many convicted sex offenders to petition to get off the registry after 10 or 20 years. Some victims' advocacy groups, like the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, support these changes. Before she bought a home in Sacramento, Mary Jean, like a lot of moms, looked up her new neighborhood online to check for sex offenders.
I was always taught that, you know, it's the stranger lurking in the park. You need to make sure it's the, you know, stranger danger. And it's like, no, there was nobody near there. Okay, we're clear.
Megan's Law made Jean feel safe. That's not her real name, by the way. We're just using it to protect her and her daughter. But that sense of safety disappeared when her daughter said she had been sexually abused since she was 11 years old.
And I just sat there and I just looked at her. By who? And she sat there and she hesitated for a minute, not sure how she should respond, but by Dad. I hated him. I never hated somebody so much. I was seething with anger.
Jean felt betrayed by her husband, but also by Megan's Law. She began to doubt that knowing about registered sex offenders can help parents avoid danger. Most sex crimes are committed by someone the victim knows and trusts, people who aren't on the registry. One of the ways she coped was by trying to understand her husband's crime and what could have prevented it. Jean's daughter pushed her to forgive her husband.
I wish he would have been able to come and talk to me. I wish that there was a way that he could have gone to a professional and asked them for help. If the stranger danger wasn't true, and if the sex offender thing wasn't, what is true?
Jean coped by delving into the research and looking for some hope for her family. She talked to me a lot about studies and data and the kind of therapy her husband needs. According to the U.S. Justice Department, sex offenders have among the lowest recidivism rates of any offenders.
These type of individuals don't change.
Paul Kelly with the San Jose Police Officers Union says sex crimes are underreported. Nationwide, only 344 out of every 1,000 sexual assaults are reported to police. Kelly says people on the list are often grateful when police check-ins find child porn or evidence of wrongdoing.
We may get them on a case and they'd say, you know, I'm glad you arrested me. It's been getting worse. I can't help my thoughts. I had touched, you know, three other boys before this one.
Kelly says changes to the registry would put children in harm's way.
I just didn't think, you know, California had so much empathy for pedophiles, you know, as a parent. Do what you have to do, raise my taxes, do anything, but do what you have to do to stop the peddling of child porn and raping of children.
Under the current bill, people convicted of felony child molestation or having child pornography would remain lifetime registrants. People convicted of other misdemeanor sex crimes, like sexual battery, sexting with someone underage, or indecent exposure, could have a chance to get off the registry after 10 or 20 years. That doesn't sit well with Kelly.
And so when we see the lower level crimes like that, we think the first thing we think in our head, which we have to because, you know, that's our job, is what's next.
Good morning, my friend. Good to see you.
These men mingling in the state capitol cafeteria all committed sex crimes in the past. They show up in Sacramento because they believe they are proof that sex offenders can change.
Robert's from Orange County. Mark's from San Jose area.
They're members of a group called the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. Their lobbying efforts have had some ups and downs this legislative session. There was a bill that would have allowed about 90% of sex offenders on the registry to petition to get off of it. But it met an abrupt and bureaucratic end in the Assembly Appropriations Committee a couple weeks ago. Then a watered-down version got stuffed into another bill and reintroduced by Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco. This latest bill could let about 30% of the state's sex offenders off the list.
We have to be optimistic. Scarlett O'Hara, tomorrow will be a better day.
There's a strange sort of camaraderie between these middle-aged men who share the experience of violating society's most basic moral code and living with the consequences. Frank Lindsay, who was convicted of lewd acts with a child nearly 40 years ago, introduces me around.
Jason just arrived, and he's got a powerful story because his daughter was kicked out of Girl Scouts because her dad's a registrant. Really, this is child abuse.
Lindsay was once attacked outside his house by a vigilante who found his address on the sex offender registry.
And he immediately raised the hammer as he moved towards me, saying, I'm going to f*** you up, you pervert. And there it was. Someone to mete out justice.
In reporting this story, I talked to a lot of sex offenders. Many are just trying to go about their lives. Some feel remorse, others don't. Mark Verba says he feels like a modern-day pariah.
Really, really sad about that.
I appreciate you coming.
Not so much for myself, but for everybody else who just continues to suffer needlessly.
To be clear, he's talking about the needless suffering of sex offenders, not victims. He also emailed me a 104-page document entitled My Story that explained why the 12-year-old victim who testified against him was a liar, because he couldn't remember exactly how many times he had been molested. Then there's others, whose remorse is convincing. Frank Lindsay no longer considers himself a sex offender. It's what he did, he says, not who he is.
I pray every day for the young lady that I had crossed the line with, because this can be something that is carried for a very long time. So I'll carry on doing my best to demonstrate that I too can heal and be whole.
Sex crimes are horrible. It's hard not to be disgusted and scared when you think about what some of these men did. If they live with lifelong stigma, imagine how victims feel. We can judge those on the registry, size up their stories, try to understand the severity of their original crime, and guess how sincere and repentant they are. The bill asks the state government to judge them on our behalf, to decide what kind of criminals should eventually be allowed off the registry and when, and who needs to be monitored for life. The bill still needs to be approved by the Assembly, then by Governor Jerry Brown. If it passes, the changes will go into effect in 2021. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
If you've got a justice story you'd like to see reported, email Holly at justice@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Our next story comes to us from our partners at San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden you heard this.
Last month, San Quentin was on lockdown for 3 weeks. It meant that volunteers couldn't come into the prison, including our KALW editorial team that works with San Quentin radio reporters. It also meant inmates' activities were severely limited. A lockdown happens when correctional officers decide there's a threat to the safety and security of a prison. That might be a fight, an assault, or a race riot. It's exactly what it sounds like. In a lockdown, inmates have to stay inside their cells until the problem is contained. They can't go anywhere unless strip searched, handcuffed, and escorted by a guard. A couple of years ago, reporter Adnan Khan brought us a story about what it's like to be inside when the prison is on lockdown. And a note to our listeners, because San Quentin radio reporters are only allowed to record in one part of the prison, they've created some of the prison sounds from inside their media lab.
A prison yard has a very unpredictable environment. Violence and lockdowns can happen at any time.
Well, my name is John Johnson. I also go by Yahya. I've been down 20 years. I've been in more lockdowns than I can remember. The longest lockdown I've been in is 10 months in Corcoran State Prison.
My name is Trevor Bird. I've been locked up 16 years, endured many lockdowns, and the longest was 8 months up at High Desert.
Here's how it starts. The first few hours of the day are spent gathering information.
There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of uncertainty and nervousness.
You're not sure what's going on. Yahya remembers how he heard something bad had happened.
Eventually, my cellie came in, and he had this look of bewilderment on his face. I said, man, what happened out there? He said, man, it was bad. It was a race riot. And I looked at his face, man, and I seen the terror in his eyes, and I was like, wow.
That race riot was the start of a 10-month lockdown. At the beginning, you don't know how long it's going to last. During lockdowns, there's absolutely no movement unless you're handcuffed and escorted by officers. Inmates find ways to communicate with each other by doing things like yelling on the tiers, talking through the ventilation system, or even taking advantage of the escort.
sometimes your only chance to communicate with somebody else is, you know, maybe on a quick little 15-second walk to the shower.
Adapting is key for any form of survival, as is preparation. Just like Bay Area residents who prepare earthquake kits, many inmates prepare by having a lockdown box, or what Bird likes to call it, a war chest.
The war chest are the basic necessities. We're not filling it with, you know, candy bars and, you know, smell good body wash. No, these are the things that you're going to need to fight off hunger and to fight off your own funk in the cell.
My particular lockdown box would consist of food and hygiene. It was mandatory to have 5 deodorants, 5 lotions, 5 toothpastes, things like that, coffee. It's a must to have 240 soups in your cell at any given time.
An earthquake kit is stocked, stored, and put away for unexpected emergencies. A lockdown box is no different.
A lockdown box is never really generally touched. You know, it's something that you know that you're gonna have to rely on at some point in a long lockdown, so it's a box that's taken, placed under the bed, and it's out of sight.
Eventually, the lockdown box diminishes and they run out of supplies. The 3 meals a day the state provides is not nearly enough for an adult, and the hunger becomes unbearable.
You know, hollowness in your gut. I mean, that your belly just grinding on your backbone, and the hunger pains. You know, look to that sack lunch, and a graham cracker, you know, just might be enough to let you fall asleep that night.
The same meal is repeated over and over, so the men have to use their imaginations.
Sometimes that loaf of bread could turn into, you know, mama's lasagna, mom's fried chicken.
You know, so when we ate these peanut butter sandwiches, it was always considered a steak, you know, with A1 steak sauce being the jelly. You know, our imaginations run wild again because you're confined to this cell and you're coping.
I mean, your mind wanders and your mind, you know, tries to fill in the gaps of what could be and what should be, but what really isn't.
You know, and you find yourself being creative and imaginative to make the food more palatable when you eat it.
Mix up that Kool-Aid and sip it slowly like it's, you know, your favorite soft drink or something, or a smoothie.
Within a few weeks, men establish routines for themselves and with their cellies.
So a lot of the time is, you know, spent dividing up the time on the floor. So you're either on your rack or you're on the floor. And there's not enough room for both of you to be on the floor at the same time. So we divide it evenly and tippy-toe around each other like that.
Still, being barricaded with another man for 24 hours a day for several months and basically a room the size of a bathroom can be extremely challenging.
Being on a lockdown with an individual that you're not compatible with is hell. You know, it works your nerves. You have to have good coping mechanisms in order not to go crazy in one of these small prison cells.
During lockdowns, men can only shower every 2 days, so they find methods of cleaning themselves inside their cells daily, which is known as a bird bath.
Splash down, suds up, you know, with your little sink and your little trickle of water that comes out. Usually we got some ladle of some type, usually it's your mug. You're using your sink and your toilet to corral all the water and a few floor towels to, you know, sop up the excess.
Since visits and phone calls are restricted, the only form of communicating with family members is through letters.
You know, I write my family. I have a son. I have a granddaughter. My mother, they're active, you know, participants in, you know, doing this prison time with me.
And my letter going out can reach my family within a couple days. It takes about 15 to 20 days sometimes for one of their letters to reach me.
But Bird and his dad found creative ways to make their letters during the lockdown a bit more interesting.
We'd start up a game of chess, and it was not out of the norm to, you know, just send off a letter with nothing but a simple chess move in it. P.S. Pop, Queen's Bishop to E5. Check. Talk about a slow game of chess. There's no time on the clock there because I'm waiting 15 to 20 days for his responding move.
So how were those chess games?
A slow, well thought out game of chess was great. And I mean, my dad and I, you know, certainly enjoyed those.
But lockdowns are very psychologically challenging.
Just being stuck in that cell without movement day after day after day, I struggled to, you know, stay sociable.
Having been locked down confined to a cell with minimal movement. The maintenance of my sanity. Not being able to go to the canteen, not being able to get a package, not being able to visit your people.
And I would. I'd spend, you know, 3-4 days in my own head. But that would be 3-4 days that I didn't write a letter. Didn't even say a word to my cellie. 3-4 days just spent in a depression.
Yahya and Bird did utilize their lockdown time productively. Yahya learned to speak Arabic, and Bird earned his AA degree taking correspondence courses through the mail. But neither of them would ever want to do another lockdown again.
No way. They're just too much wear and tear on the soul.
Absolutely not. Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land and learn things without being confined in a box.
For the San Quentin Prison Report, I'm a non-con.
San Quentin Radio is a project in which KALW editors train inmates to report stories from inside prison. San Quentin officials listened to and approved the script and audio for this story prior to broadcast. Thanks to Sam Robinson and Larry Schneider for their help. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Aisha Claudi grew up a black child in segregated Louisiana. Her life journey has taken her through the black church, the Nation of Islam. She lived through and was very aware of the hurtful racial divides in this country, and she was always trying to find ways to mend these deep social wounds. In the early 80s, Aisha came across the spiritual teachings of a psychiatrist named Gerald Jampolsky. He taught a mental healing philosophy called attitudinal healing. It intrigued Aisha, and when she opened a center for children with life-threatening disease, she used the concept to help them. It worked, so she thought maybe racial wounds could also be healed by this method. So in 1989, she founded Attitudinal Healing Connections in Oakland, and since then, she's worked on what she's coined racial attitudinal healing. So how does it work? Aisha Claudi joined me in studio to explain.
Attitudinal healing. What is that?
It's non-traditional mental health. There are 12 principles.
12.
The first one is the essence of our being is love. The second one is health is inner peace. Healing is letting go of fear. And children were using these principles to heal their beliefs and attitudes about their diseases. And that's when I really looked at race. And I said, racism is a life-threatening illness that's killing people all over the world. It's not just whites and blacks here, but when you go to Ghana and you go to the Sudan and you see people using bleaching cream and chemicals on their hair, and everybody want to be white because somehow it's beautiful. Then you look at the number of young people who are dying as a result of color issues and the number of young black men. And you see this society, how it's really has used race as a platform for increasing wealth among a certain group. So, of course, people are going to think, oh, I'd be much happier if I was white because I would have more money. And not realizing that wealth is not really based on color. But this society created this belief that wealth is based on color. And so that's when I began to really look at this in a very deeper way and said, we have work to do. And I met Kokoman, who was from Ghana, West Africa.
Your partner.
My partner. And we began to hold racial healing circles. And these circles was grounded in the belief that racism is a life-threatening illness.
So this was then, so 1989, you founded Attitudinal Healing Connections.
Yes, yes.
Tell me about the founding. Like, what? How did you go from saying to yourself, "We need to do something," to then actually starting something? Mm-hmm. What was that process like?
It was a long process. Nothing happens overnight. So it was a process of really first holding just small group circles.
What is a group circle? Can you describe it?
A small group is about maybe 4 or 5 people. First, it would be just me and Kokoman, and we would invite people over to have this conversation. And people would be like, you guys are crazy. I don't need this work around race. I don't need this work. But basically, we realized that we needed it.
What, so, how would conversations go in that circle?
We would read the principles of attitudinal healing. We created some guidelines. The guideline was based on the American Anthropological Association belief that the concept of race is a human construction. Hmm. It does not exist among the human species. That we would really look at that and talk about that. And then after we did the principles of attitude, we use a talking piece. And a talking piece is that an ancient Native American way of letting everybody be heard. And so the talking stick, we would pass the talking stick. And the rules were that if this person has the talking stick, they are the one that's doing the talking. We're not to interrupt that person. We're not to try to correct them. If we disagree with them, we wanted to create a safe place where people can just, if a person was an out-and-out bigot and really hated other people because they didn't look like them, we weren't there to change them. They could be as much of a bigot as they wanted to be. That wasn't our job.
What was your job?
Our job was to create a safe place where they could talk about this, whatever it is that's on their mind.
Even bigotry.
Even bigotry. Even hatred. Because bottom line, you have to believe, we really totally believe that underneath all of that was a good human being.
You believe that everybody is good.
And everybody is good. Because if you look at, if you think about it, there are people who are raising kids and, you know, they may raise their kids to hate other people. But bottom line, you know that they have this loving energy inside of them. How can they take this love and energy and to begin to extend it to everyone?
So after a possible bigot has said something that me, who is sitting in the circle, that makes me feel really bad, what is the next step that is
when
it, that you want?
When you get the talking piece, you get to talk about how you felt hearing that person.
Mm-hmm.
They get to listen. And so that's the whole idea. Usually what we don't do, we don't hear each other. If I'm saying something very mean-spirited to you, you're blasting me back. So you're really not hearing me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're blasting me back and talking about how you felt, how you feel, and you're not going to take this, I'm not really listening to you because I'm trying to get my point across. So that's the whole idea, is to really create a space where people can be heard.
Because when they are heard, then what happens?
I think when people, I believe 100% that when people are heard, then and only then they're able to let it go. Because the whole idea of the principles of attitude is that we can let go of anything. So once you let it go and you let it, you really release it and you lay it down, you can go back and pick it up. But you know that you go, you understand that you pick that back up.
One of your core principles is forgiveness, that we should be forgiving. What does forgiving mean? Does it mean forgetting? Does it mean?
Forgiveness first just means just letting go.
What? How do you let go?
It doesn't mean you. It doesn't mean you forget. Because let's face it, people, we don't forget things. Most of us don't. Not walking around with Alzheimer's, where we're in the moment. All it would be nice where we're in the moment all the time, but most of us are. We regurgitate our past
because it's hurtful.
Because
slavery, Jim Crow, institutional racism, it's a lot.
I think that sometimes it's hurtful, but sometimes we as human beings, we want to have a reason not to forgive. So I can't force you to forgive me for the mean things I've done, but I can ask you for forgiveness and I can let it go.
Mm. I want to talk about one of your 12 principles that that I found interesting and really relevant to what many of us are feeling these days, which is number 8. We can choose and direct ourselves to be peaceful inside regardless of what's happening outside. And in these times, since the election of Trump, since this new, or other people are saying not so new, these racial divides that are happening, this mistrust that is happening, you know, that's what's happening on the outside. And a lot of us are drained, and a lot of us are suspicious of the other. But this principle is saying, despite all of that, you can choose to be peaceful. How does that
happen? See, that's why we wrote the book on happiness, Our Eternal Quest for Happiness. Because when you really look at it and you really begin to see that you can be peaceful, you have a decision, a choice to make. You can choose to be peaceful inside, regardless of what is going on outside. It's a choice you make. I can choose. And that's the power that I have. So once we see that we can either give our power away or we can maintain our power, that what we think, we get to choose how we feel about it. Mm. We may not choose what happened to us, but we can choose what we do about it. Once we begin to see that you have that kind of power, I think it's really, really important so we can choose and direct ourselves to be peaceful inside, regardless of what is happening outside.
It feels like being in a healing circle is a powerful experience, kind of one-on-one, and for people within that healing circle. Is there a way to take that and implement it on a mass scale where, like, how can a community or a country benefit from this idea?
I think that this would be so powerful because if all over, I think Hillsboro, it was so funny, they got rid of their police department. And the way they were able to do that, because all the people were familiar with each other. And I think if you do those small circles in every community, you just identify groups of people that want to hold circles. We usually wait until something bad happens. It's like America is at its best when catastrophe happens. But if we could just realize that, you know, let's not wait till something bad happens. Let's get to know each other and let's pull together now. And I think the way that we can begin to have small circles all over, first you start with the police department. You start with your teachers. Right now, we are in about 15 schools throughout Oakland. We were in San Francisco. And each one of those schools, we hold small circles for those kids. And when we meet with their parents, we hold small circles for those parents. But if everybody did that and realized that we all are connected, we all are joined, that's the first thing we have to really begin to see. That as human beings, we all have something in common. Just two eyes, a nose, a mouth, our eyebrows, our cheeks, we smile, we laugh, we all like good food, you know. So these are the things we have to start looking at. What do we have in common? We start with what we have in common. And then you branch out and you begin to identify those.
But enough people have to want to come and believe and do the work for this to make change.
That is the work. Enough people. And I think that that's why I think that we have an opportunity now because everybody's talking about race. Everybody's talking about language. Everybody's talking about differences. So now it's like, okay, what are we going to do about it? So this is the time to really implement those circles. Because I think we got everybody's ear. When we first wrote the book, Beyond Fear, 12 Spiritual Keys to Racial Healing, no one, this was 20 years ago, no one wanted to talk. They said, this issue don't exist. Why are you making this up? But look right now, it's all over the place.
It's your time. It's your time, Miss Aisha.
No, I think.
Will they hear now?
I was just looking at James Baldwin and a conversation between James Baldwin and William F. Buckley. This is in 1965. It was as if they were talking about issues that was current in 2017.
So this is not new.
This is not new.
Why do we feel like it is?
I think we've always looked at who to blame and not really looked at. Whenever you point a finger at someone, three fingers are pointed back at you. I think whenever we can realize that we've never done this work, we've never done this work. When Bill Clinton called for a dialogue on race, that's when he was in office. It didn't really happen. Only people who were in high, high positions did it just to please him, not because this is an issue that really needed to be addressed.
Hmm.
So my thing is that we've never really done the work. Just go on YouTube. Everything is on YouTube. You can look at all the past conversations. You can look at all the things that Malcolm X was saying. It's the same. So my thing is that we've never really done our work. We all retreat into our tribal corners, but we've never said, we're human beings. How can we let this go? What do we need to do? Where is my rage, my guilt, my shame? So at least if you get upset, you blow up. How much can you blow up?
Mm-hmm. And that's okay in a circle, to blow up?
It's okay in a circle.
Okay.
Because the circles should be able to hold that.
Mm-hmm. And by the end of that circle, what should I have left with?
By the end of that circle, you should have left with a minimum of belief that you can heal. That whatever it is, you can heal it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you being here.
Yes,
well,
this is good.
We hope people are listening and people will start to do the work.
Oh, gosh, that's a lot.
You said it, not me.
That's racial healing pioneer Aisha Clotty, founder of Oakland's Attitudinal Healing Connections and author of many books, including Beyond Fear, 12 Spiritual Keys to Racial Healing. And there's a new film coming out about her and her work called Imaginary Walls. Check them out.